Detectives. I'm Rod Hill, FM News.
Quiet, please, ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
What started as a rather peaceful demonstration has turned into criminal behavior.
Colleges and universities all over America have delivered that same kind of reaction to the protests and the encampments and literally the takeover of buildings where pro-Hamas terrorist protesters in America are protesting by taking over buildings, taking over libraries, taking over sections of large campuses. Well, the reaction has been, well, in the protests in favor of hating Jewish people, hating Israel, and most consequently, hating the United States of America. At the end of the day, this is not just about Jews. It's not just about Israel. These are groups that have been indoctrinated on American college campuses, and they hate the United States of America. And they're using, in reaction to this, some of the same language that we heard 4 years ago when the deadly and even murderous riots that occurred, you know, Antifa and Black Lives Matter and that whole bunch, mostly peaceful protests, except when they turned violent. And that became a punchline for the joke that is our current political leadership. I want to give you a few thoughts on that, but first, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I even expect we'll get a few naysayers today, and that's okay. If you want to join in, it's 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we'll put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails, and that's easy too, talk@LarsLarson.com. And if you want to vote in our poll on X, this one's very simple. Can a judge constitutionally gag a criminal trial defendant like President Donald Trump? My answer to that would be no. And yet and still, a few hours ago, a judge in New York City held Donald Trump in contempt of court for violating what is almost certainly an unconstitutional gag order. He has now fined Donald Trump $9,000, and he keeps threatening that if Trump does it one more time, he's going to throw him in jail. Let me tell you the legal reason that that judge is not going to throw Donald Trump in jail. And the reason is, and I got this from lawyers who know the case well, they say if you throw an American citizen, even if it's not Donald Trump, but if you gag order an American citizen who's on trial in a criminal trial, and then when he violates the gag order, you throw him behind bars, you put him in jail or prison, that is going to send that case right straight to the federal courts, and that's going to take some time. You know, the Democrats can't afford to take time with this very politicized prosecution of Donald Trump. I mean, they're not doing this because they think he broke the law. They came up with a cockamamie legal case to say, we've got to do this because, well, Donald Trump's going to run and he's going to win and he's winning right now. And we have this pathetic old, demented old man, Joe Biden, who's failing more and more every single day. They've got to do something about it. So what do? They gag him, but the judge only hit him with a fine today. And there was one good piece of news. This is the same judge who a couple of weeks ago literally told Donald Trump, I will not give you one day off from this criminal trial at which you are required to be present in order to attend your son's graduation from high school. Barron Trump is graduating. At the very least, this judge has decided to throw Donald Trump a bone. But let me get back to what's going on these college campuses. Cheese-eating surrender monkeys, well, they got nothing on the appeasement crowd that runs America's colleges. And that's true as well in Portland, right in the backyard of our broadcast studios. PSU, the Portland State University President Ann Kudd, and Mayor Feckless Ted Wheeler, the lame duck mayor of Portlandia, and refused to prosecute a George Soros special, if there ever was one, Mike Schmidt, shared a microphone at a press conference, I kid you not, that took place an hour before midnight last night. And why were they doing that? because one more of these protests had gone predictably out of control. Last week, the pro-Hamas terrorism crowd caused enough problems in Portland's park blocks that police finally came in and kicked them out. So what does a sensible university president like Ann Cudd do? I'm being sarcastic, by the way. She invites them to set up camp at the university's library. Listen to what she said.
I met with the protesters and talked to them. I asked them who they are. They said they were faculty, staff, and students, but also community members at that time. I asked them to please keep let us have access to the library open.
Now, hold on a second. Taxpayers give this philosophy professor, who's now a university president, but her degree is in philosophy. If you ever wondered what somebody could possibly do with a degree in philosophy, you become a university president, and you get two-thirds of $1 million a year from the taxpayers in salary to make great administrative decisions for the university you run. Well, this certainly ain't one of them. Cudd then asked these friends of Hamas, would you pretty please allow the university to have access to its university library? I mean, the Babylon Bee couldn't make this kind of stuff up. So last night, the terrorism supporters, they weren't going to go along with it, what the university president said to do. I mean, she'd given them permission. After they created trouble, were kicked out of the parks by the police, she said, well, you can set up here at our library. Just please let us have access to the library. Well, last night, that wasn't good enough. They broke into the library, and the police say they fortified their occupation. Listen to this.
With the breaching of the library and the fortification going on at the library, this has now become a criminal event, and it's no longer considered to be a public order or free speech event, and requires a different type of response.
Yeah, thanks, Captain Obvious. Of course it does, and yet are you actually going to do that? And where does all that appeasement leave us? Well, the entire university is shut down today, just like a lot of America's universities are getting shut down by this very thing. So what does the local prosecutor have to say about it? Listen to Mike Schmidt.
Well, all of us up here are committed to working to protect freedom of speech. The actions taking place today with the occupation of the library have crossed the line into criminal behavior.
Yeah, criminal behavior. No kidding. Could you tell? The DA made some noises about criminal prosecution, but I don't believe much of anything that guy promises. After all, he's backed by George Soros. George Soros is backing DAs all over America who promise, as prosecutors, that they aren't going to prosecute criminals. And, of course, this year is an election year. He needs the votes to keep his job. Listen to this.
Let me be clear. We will prosecute the cases. Pending review of evidence, of course, that we was able to be collected, provided by law enforcement, I expect that felony charges could be filed, depending on what evidence we gather, including burglary and felony criminal mischief, along with other potential misdemeanors.
Yeah, okay. He says, and once we've looked at all the evidence, then we'll decide what to charge. That gives him an escape hatch. And what does the lame duck, feckless mayor of the city of Portlandia have to say?
The university, the city, the county, the prosecutors, the police, we're all unified. And we will not allow acts of criminal destruction or violence to carry the day in our city.
Now, if you actually believe that, I suggest you take a test drive through his failed downtown first, where he's allowed about 4 years of criminal violence and drug use and homelessness and all the rest. It's so dangerous, people don't want to go there. And at the University of Oregon, the same thing. Sorry, at the University of Washington. At the University of Washington, they literally have some of these Hamas friends saying, hey, go back to the gas chamber. You got the Lars Larson show.
The sound of freedom. Here's Lars Larson.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense. right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper or mainstream media bias.
We are sending some bizarre messages to young criminals here in the Pacific Northwest these days. Consider what happened in one courtroom recently as a judge gave a slap on the wrist to an adult man who committed a serious crime. The perp stood in front of Judge Kelly Skye, and I'd love to talk to Judge Skye about this, because police caught him on New Year's Eve engaging in illegal street racing. But on top of that, they found him armed with a gun that he possessed illegally. So what did Judge Skye decide was the right punishment? Some time in jail, maybe a little time in prison? No, 40 hours of community service. That's all. No time in jail at all. And why would Judge Skye decide that illegal possession of a gun by somebody who's committing other crimes that might bring him into conflict with other innocent citizens, why does that merit just a few Saturdays of picking up litter? I'll give you the judge's quote, courtesy of journalist Pamela Fitzsimmons, who writes at Substack, "You're 23 years old. Your brain is still developing." Now, I've heard that nonsense that men under the age of 26 have been using lately. My brain isn't fully formed, so I can't be held responsible. Well, in that case, why let you vote or drink or sign a contract before your 26th birthday? Otherwise, if you're an adult at 18 for all the other things that you'd like to do, you're an adult for the penalties you break under the law. And then this reminder, Oregon's last day today to register and choose your party affiliation to vote in the upcoming primary election for the people we want to see on November ballots. If you're not registered already, and that's very few people are not registered, this is certainly the deadline day. And email on the campus takeovers. Bruce writes in, "Lars, Portland State University has 50 protesters, spoiled brats, break in a library, and the mayor and the DA say charges will be filed. What happened in 2020 when they were burning the city? They want us to pay their student loans," signed Bruce. And our question of the day, Nick, I thought, had a good analysis. "Hey, Lars, well, the mayor has painted himself into another corner. Peaceful protesters have now resorted to criminal mischief, graffiti, trespass, and breaking into a building. And Lars, this time, quote, he won't stand for it." Well, now as he's making the statement, standing behind him is the new police chief, who looks like a leashed dog just waiting and ready to be turned loose and put an end to this nonsense. What does little Teddy Wheeler have to lose at this point? He's not running for re-election. Turn the cops loose and let them enforce the law. You want your beloved city to fall deeper back into the crap hole and the other mostly peaceful protests turned Portland into a few years ago? And when it comes to these spoiled children who've grown up in an age of never hearing the word no, getting participation trophies, and never once getting spanked, it's time for Mr. Feckless to put his words into action. Time to go clean out the library at PSU, signed Nick. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
Well, today's Daily Grill is suggested by the Seattle journalist Jay Cho, that Jonathan Cho, who wrote this. "Last night, more than 100 migrants, I prefer to think of them as illegal aliens, invaded Seattle's Central District and took over Powell Barnett Park, a popular play area for kids and dogs. Now there are more than 30 tents set up on the grassy area and wooden pallets are scattered everywhere. Group leaders say they won't leave till more money is provided for better living conditions. Sure sounds like extortion. And by the way, they pulled this extortion trick before, and as long as it works, and it has worked out for them, they're going to keep on extorting." Jay Cho says the usual far-left activists were there to help this massive move. "Old friend Rosario Lopez Hernandez spotted me and chased me out of the encampment with a cardboard box. She's facing charges for disrupting a Seattle City Council meeting in February. Council member Joy Hollingsworth and Mayor Bruce Harrell say there are no more city resources and state funds won't be available for a few more months. So what now?" And today's best email, but you can always send more. Paula Klein writes in, Lawrence, during the Vietnam War, protesters were Americans objecting to the unnecessary deaths of Americans in a war believed to be based on rumors. Today's demonstrators are fighting a cause for the sake of politics and personal agendas for other countries, but on U.S. soil. Their demands aren't for America's benefit, and they aren't civil or intended to be shared peacefully. Current campus disruption is the continuing disorder from current Democrat Party decisions. It's globally understood that America is now borderless and weak. Criminals and communists are invited and encouraged to come and shred the American dream and eliminate Christianity. Protests in the 60s were pro-American citizens who believed they were defending American lives. Protests on U.S. soil today are anything but pro-America. They are pro-illegal alien, pro-terrorist, pro-drug cartel, pro-woke, pro-death, and pro-destruction. Today's agitators are several small groups with many different causes, and they all jump in together on the chaos train for the thrill of attention and U.S. demolition because it's allowed. Signed, Paula from Washington. Glad to be with you and always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and we've served the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the last 25 years or so. If you're a naysayer, we'll put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com and our poll on X today. Can a judge constitutionally gag a criminal defendant like President Donald Trump? My answer to that is no. Now, I'm not a lawyer, but I don't think you can do that under the First Amendment to the Constitution, not as broadly as this judge in New York City has done. He has now fined President Trump a few hours ago, fined him $9,000, and threatened him with time in jail. But I told you, they're not going to throw him in jail. That will immediately make a constitutional question about whether or not this judge can even do the gag order that he's done. Let me tell you about something that's developed in the last hour or so. Joe Biden plans to rewrite America's medical pot rules. Now, be very clear. There are a lot of media out there right now that are saying this is just eliminating or easing federal restrictions on cannabis, but only for medical purposes. Now, I know that scam. Oregon and Washington ran that scam for a long time. People said, oh, I'm getting it for medical purposes. They were getting it to get high. And then drug legalization for recreational use came along. Right now, by federal law, pot is still a Schedule I drug. So I reached out to a legal friend of mine, Josh Markey, and I said, can the president unilaterally just change the Drug Control Act of 1970 and take marijuana off the schedule? He said he can do it temporarily, but any permanent change has to be done by the United States Congress. And right now, truth be told, there aren't the votes in the House or the Senate to pass legalization of pot. So be very clear. Number one, this is only temporary. In other words, Joe wants this to work till about November 5th, 2024, the day of the election. I don't think he gives a damn after that. He's going to lose anyway, and he won't be in that position. But he's making a temporary change, and only for pot that is used for medicinal purposes. Any permanent change to the schedule, to having marijuana on the federal schedule of drugs, is going to have to be done by the Congress. And if you haven't noticed already, the U.S. Congress is not doing much for Joe Biden these days. Glad to take your calls on this Tuesday at 866-439-5277. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Listening because you like what you hear, right? Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Tuesday. Always glad to get to your calls. I mentioned to you, as the Daily Grill suggested by journalist Jonathan Cho at the Discovery Institute, that we've now got another bunch of illegal aliens in Seattle's Central District. And I guess they figured that if we used extortion before and got what we wanted, I think the last time they occupied either a school grounds or a park, and they demanded more money for their hotel bill, and they got it. So they figure, well, if it worked once, it can work again. I don't know if Jonathan Cho shares that conclusion, but I'm glad to welcome him back to the show. How are you, Jay Cho? How's things going?
Yeah, Lars, surprised but not surprised that we're dealing with another situation like this again. More than 100 illegal immigrants. By the way, the same group that tried to extort the city and county the last time for funds, back at it, now at a different park. Late Monday afternoon, they essentially decided to set up dozens of tents at Powell Barnett Park. This is a historic black neighborhood in Seattle's Central District, just minutes from downtown. The neighbors had no idea what was going on. Many of them woke up and saw my video this morning and then looked outside their doors and were just shocked. I reached out to Councilmember Joy Hollingsworth, who represents the area. She's closely monitoring the situation. But look, bottom line, how about some enforcement, right?
Yeah. Well, and in fact, Joy Hollingsworth and Bruce Harrell, the mayor, have both said, look, we don't have any cash for this kind of thing. So the extortionists have run the victims out of cash. And did these two not understand that if you pay off the extortionist once, that will not be the last time you're going to have to pay off the extortionist, because that's how extortion works?
Yeah, it just it's these politicians, these elected officials, they are trying to appease the migrants here, these asylum seekers, and they think you give them an inch, you know, they won't take a mile. Well, guess what? That's happening right now, and there's no end in sight. In fact, what else is happening right now is I have people on the ground who work with the migrants very closely right now, and others in the area, and there are many illegal immigrants here, they're being advised now to set up shop in this park, hoping for resources if that comes.
Okay, so tell me this. As I understand, unless they've been given, and the Biden administration has handed out a certain number of work permits, but the vast majority of the people who've entered the country illegally have been given an appearance date, a ticket, basically, by Customs and Border Protection, but they're arriving in cities. I'm not saying this to draw sympathy to them, but they're arriving with no legal authority to work any job whatsoever. So they are going to be 100% dependent on the city. Does the city of Seattle understand that? That all of the illegal aliens in the city are either going to have to steal what they need just to fulfill their needs, or you're going to have to give them the money, one way or the other, as long as they're here until they're told to leave?
Well, they're going to be getting some money. The state recently released a few million dollars for these illegal immigrants, but they're not going to see any of that until potentially mid to late summer. So in the meantime, you hear stories of some of these migrants working odd jobs. And look, I'm not implying that they're all criminals, but, you know, you're also hearing stories of theft coming from these groups just to kind of stay afloat. And what's also maddening to a lot of the Americans on the streets, living on the streets homeless, is that the migrants are, many of them are driving vehicles right now. They've been given driver's licenses. They've been given stipends to survive. And let me be very clear. This group of about 100 plus was originally staying at Riverton Park United Methodist Church in Tukwila. But during the cold snap earlier this year, around this, you know, around January, they demanded they go into the motels. But the pastor at the church said, hey, I can't guarantee you what happens after that. So she gave these migrants money to stay in the motels. And ever since, they've been trying to figure out what to do next. And right now, the protest and setting up in this park is the next best option.
Well, and Jonathan, I guess I don't see anybody on the Seattle City Council who are objecting, and they should be, or among the general public, other than you as a journalist doing it. But when I saw in Denver, where Denver's looking at 40,000 illegals in its city, and that's the estimate, a woman stepped up to the city council lectern to testify as a member of the public and said, look, if you've got to spend $1,000, just $1,000 a month to house, feed, clothe, and care for each one of these 40,000 people, that's $40 million a month. That's $500 million a year. So the fact that the legislature or the state government has freed up what sounds like a lot of money, millions of dollars, even tens of millions, that's going to evaporate quickly, isn't it?
Yeah, you hit it right on the head, Lars. This is a Band-Aid. This is a temporary fix. You were talking about the asylum hearings. Yeah, they're here right now waiting in line. But some of these asylum hearing court dates won't be happening at least for the next 2, 3, maybe even 4 years.
Yep.
So they're here right now draining resources. Their kids have to go to public schools. The 911 calls to many of these migrant camps are off the charts. And they're all being paid for by taxpayer dollars.
And the number I always have to mention, Jonathan, because I've checked it again and again, what percentage of asylum seekers get a yes from the federal courts? And the answer is at most 15%. The other 85% are told you don't qualify. You're not fleeing persecution, and under federal law, you don't qualify. So we're seeing cities that are draining resources away from legitimate needs of actual citizens and paying the money to support the existence of people, the vast majority of whom are going to be told in 2 or 3 years, you can't be here anyway, you have to leave. So we're draining all this money out, all these resources, and in some cities, I don't know if Seattle's hit this yet, but as you point out, the 911 calls are off the charts, the cities are already short of police and other resources, and then you say, and we're going to drain a bunch of money, you know, when they say we're going to suck all this money out, it's got to come from somewhere. Does it come from police? Does it come from fire? Does it come from medical? Does it come from parks? Does it come from school? It's got to come from somewhere, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think really what's becoming more evident now than ever as the weeks and months go by for many of the neighbors in this region, you know, initially they were sympathetic, they wanted to help, but many of these migrants are starting to develop this attitude of entitlement. Again, being a part of these protests, demanding resources, demanding money, demanding certain conditions instead of what's being offered. Again, many of these people were staying at Riverton Park United Methodist Church, but the conditions there weren't good enough, so they decided to venture off on their own, and this is what's happening.
And they go to a hotel, and somebody pays their bill for a while, and when the money stops, they go out and stage one of these so-called protests or occupations, and of course it leaves the police in a spot where, what do? Arrest these people and put them where? Or write them tickets, which they're free to ignore because their status in the country is already illegal. What do they care about a ticket? You know, it doesn't mean anything to them. Anything else that's significant about what is happening? And are there other groups that are watching this example and saying, well, why don't we do the same thing?
Yeah, there are, because this particular group, they've been getting away with making these demands because some of these lawmakers are caving. So there are other groups right now that are kind of sitting tight, seeing where things shake out, are now realizing, wait, we can make a move as well. So it's really turning into this hot mess, and it's really becoming a free-for-all right now, Lars.
Jonathan, we appreciate your reporting. Thanks for the work you do with the Discovery Institute, and I appreciate your time today.
All right. Thank you, Lars.
That is Jonathan Cho. You can follow him on social media, J Cho on X. And of course, you can hear him here on this show as well. Coming up in a moment, I want to get to your phone calls and emails. And guess what? Remember when Oregon lost the data for 3.5 million driver's licenses, basically every driver's license that Oregon had issued? Well, guess what? At least a couple of the people have created a class action suit lawsuit against everybody who was affected because their name, their address, their date of birth, their social security number, all of it was hacked, and now they want some justice. We'll get to that too. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Simply by listening, you're proving how smart you really are. Lars thanks you.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I think this might actually produce some justice. A pair of Oregonians, Carrie Evangelist, great name, and Brian Ells, I don't know them, but they have filed a lawsuit that seeks to make a class action lawsuit on behalf of 3.5 million Oregon residents. I happen to have a Washington state driver's license, so I'm safe. But there was a massive international data breach last year. It involved people's names, addresses, date of birth, last four digits of social security numbers, height, weight, the whole Marianne. And they're saying the state has to pay up. They have to set this right. And I think they're right about that. This segment of the show is brought to you by 540training.com, concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense. You'll find them online at 540training.com. Let me go first to Randall, who's listening in Cave Junction and on the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, Randall, what's on your mind today?
Hi, how you doing there, Lars? Been listening to you for a while. It's been very enjoyable, very informative. I was
calling to discuss
a little bit about the marijuana legalization for medical. Being a user for, since 1968, I lived in Greenwich Village. The only thing pot has ever done for me or anyone I know is get them high. None of us, the creams, the this, the that, it's all a fraud. It's just a way to make it legal.
I agree. And in Joe Biden's case, the action he took that we learned about an hour and a half ago is that he wants to remove marijuana from what's called Schedule 1 of the federal drug laws. So it's up there with heroin and LSD and a lot of other drugs. He can't do that without Congress. He can do it temporarily, and that's it. And then he has to go to the Congress. And all this covers is so-called medical marijuana, which I share the notion medical marijuana is a scam. I mean, there are some conditions like glaucoma and a few others that can be treated. And there's an argument that there may be some medical use. But for the most part, back when Oregon first allowed medical marijuana and then later legalized it for recreation, doctors testified to the legislature there were maybe 2,000 people in the whole state who could make a medical use of marijuana. By the time recreational legalization came around, there were 80,000 people who had marijuana cards, and I'm reasonably sure they shared them. So, in other words, they were just using it as a way to get high, and I agree with you. Randall, thanks. Let's go to Troy. Hey, Troy, thanks for calling. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Lars, I'm calling in to talk about the U.S. support for Israel. And I want folks to remember, and I know you do have Democrat voters who are listening to this show.
Oh, yeah.
I do want them to remember that right now the Senate is controlled by Democrats. Joe Biden is obviously a Democrat. So these people that are out there protesting for Palestine and everything, they need to remember it is Joe Biden and the Democrats that are pushing for this.
Yeah, that's true. And you know the specific things these protesters say they're demanding? I mean, some of it is so cockamamie it doesn't make sense. For example, at Portland State University, they want PSU to cut all ties with Boeing. Because Boeing has both a civilian side, passenger jets, and they also have a military side. But the only thing Boeing does at PSU, they give out, I think, $28,000 in scholarships, and they gave $150,000 to PSU just as a gift. They got the naming rights to a classroom. So it's the Boeing classroom, or it's the Boeing gathering space or conference room or whatever. So they have almost no ties with Boeing. And what would that do to Boeing? Would Boeing say, wow, if PSU is no longer connected to us and taking our scholarship money, we think we'll get out of the military industrial complex altogether? And they also want to cut all ties with any companies that do business with Israel. Well, let me give you a great example that I saw mentioned a moment ago, and it was on X, on social media. Do you know that Amazon does a lot of business with Israel? So one way to answer the complaints of these idiots that are protesting in favor of a terrorist group would say, let's have PSU say no more Amazon deliveries at all on campus. Nobody who works here, nobody who's a student here, Amazon deliveries are now forbidden on campus. How long do you think that would last if they stopped doing Amazon deliveries at, say, the University of Washington and PSU and U of O and OSU?
Absolutely. Well, and I am a staunch conservative, Lars, and I guess the silver lining for me in this whole what they're doing at the campuses and whatnot, I hope that they do give these kids felonies. Felons can't vote.
Well, actually, in Oregon and in Washington, in Oregon, they can, but sad to say. Let's go to Rex. Hey, Rex, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, I got a question.
question. What is the difference between what all these quote-unquote students and protesters are doing is different than what they're saying happened on January 6th as far as insurrection? What's the difference?
Well, because you want me to give you the liberal argument is that having some protesters go into the Capitol building was an attempt to take over the government of the United States, which was ridiculous because it wasn't. And it was over in a few hours. In the case of these campus protests, they have lasted for days, and they have taken over buildings, and they have seized control of buildings. So there's a bit of difference there. But, yeah, why? If you want to say, okay, some of these kids should go to prison for 20 years. If you're going to send somebody from J6 to prison for 20 years, then take some of the campus yahoos and do the same thing to them. I appreciate the call, Rex. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll be glad to get back to your phone calls and emails in a bit. It's a Tuesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's my pleasure to be with you. And if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day. Our poll on X today, can a judge constitutionally gag a defendant like Donald Trump? Well, that's what the judge has done in New York City. And a few hours ago, the judge decided that Donald Trump had violated the judge's gag order, constitutional or not, and that Donald Trump would be ordered to pay a $9,000 fine for doing that. But he hasn't thrown him in jail yet. And I don't think he's going to, because if he does, I think that one goes right to the federal courts, where the federal courts would be forced to rule on the constitutional question. Can a judge sentence any or send any American citizen to jail for not following his gag order? You'll find the question, can a judge constitutionally gag a defendant like President Donald Trump? My answer is no. You can find it at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, let me bring on Brent Barker, who is running for Secretary of State in the state of Oregon. And ordinarily, Brent, you know, this is the kind of office that used to be was not paid a lot of attention by the general public. So welcome back.
Well, thank you, Lars. It's great to be back with you again. And the Lars Larson Show is definitely fabulous here in the Northwest. Yeah, we've got a problem right now with election interference, it appears,
yep.
on a national level. But on a state level, you know, I look to, through my training and dispute resolution at Pepperdine University Law, I look to bring a balanced approach to the state of Oregon because, you know, between the non-affiliated voter and the Democrat voter, they're approximately 70% of the vote count in the state of Oregon. So for a Republican-minded or an authentic Republican like myself that is a authentic and true Trump supporter, I must speak to the concerns of the Democrats and the independent voter, because I believe what they really want is for everyone to get along and come together. And I believe the office of Secretary of State should really be an office of neutrality and an office of goodwill as the ambassador for all parties and all people, so where they can get an honest, fair handshake, if you will.
Well, on that point, Brent, do you think the current Secretary of State is acting in a partisan fashion? I do, and I could point out one specific thing she's doing lately that makes it a partisan use of that office and weaponizes it for use in election. But I want your opinion first. Is the current Secretary of State acting in a neutral, bipartisan way?
You know, Lars, I love the question, but my position is anything prior to my election in the state of Oregon is pretty much off hands. I have no control over current.
Why? But why not tell people this is how the current office is running? Is it running well? Is it running badly? Is there a reason to make a change?
Yes, and that's fair. I look at the OreStar program that they have that candidates essentially through the various compliances. It works well. I did look at the, you know, our voters pamphlet, and I was curious why a national candidate like President Trump was not on the ballot or in the voters pamphlet.
He's on the ballot. He's not in the voters pamphlet. Yeah, just so everybody's clear on that. And I'm getting emails daily on that, and I've explained it, and I've said at this point the Trump campaign did not submit a statement for the voters pamphlet, and the campaign will not tell us why. Was it an oversight, or was it a deliberate move to not pay, I think it's $3,500, and submit a statement? They didn't do it, and it was the choice of the campaign, and we don't know if it was deliberate or a slip-up.
Right, yeah, and that fee. So a fee, regardless, it's a national presidential candidate, and they should be in the voters' pamphlet. So, but yes, we've got some transparency issues here. But the current Secretary of State, as far as I can see, just like our current governor, are doing better than prior people in those positions. Our current governor just signed on to a bipartisan legislation for campaign finance reform, which is so needed, but it doesn't take effect until 2028 election. But yep. Regardless, it was very well needed. We have some other things that our current governor's doing well. So
go ahead.
Yes. No, as much as I love my Republican base and the decorum of being a true and authentic Republican, we must come together to where the majority party stands and see what principles and opportunities are where we can join forces and become one. We must start uniting our state.
That all sounds very feel good, Brent. But what do you do when you're running for Secretary of State in a state where the Democrat Party took $500,000 and the way they took it was illegal? They were forced to give it back. They took it out of the FTX cryptocurrency scam. They took it under a false name. And OreStar and the Secretary of State didn't spot any of that, did they?
And there are a number of areas where the Secretary of State can use administrative rules for oversight to ensure that the voters and the taxpayers, their monies are properly placed. And these are things just like
is the current Secretary of State doing that? Because when you have a contribution that I think was Prime Trust was the name the contribution came in under, and it has to be an individual who gave the money. Now, the money came from, ultimately, Sam Bankman-Fried. But the Secretary of State allowed it to be put on the books as coming from Prime Trust, which insulated it from Nishad Singh, who worked for Sam Bankman-Fried. It's all very complicated. But the point is, that got reported and put into the, into the campaign reporting. So you say that's where the money came from. No, it didn't. It came from Sam Bankman-Fried and a fraud he was running, and the current Secretary of State did not spot any of that, right?
And that gentleman defrauded many people, and I believe that given the fact that many candidates do need resources in order to campaign.
No, but should the Secretary of State have spotted that when money is given from, just a name of a company, a business entity? Should that have been spotted?
It's questionable at those levels of dollars. It seems like it would raise a red flag. This is where you would think. But with complete fairness and transparency, I do not have access to those rules right now. And I believe the current Secretary of State is doing her very best in order to do the best job that she can do, because
interesting. Brent Barker is running for Secretary of State as a Republican. We'll be back in a moment talking about your phone calls and emails. And the FBI raid on Mar-a-Lago was a setup from the beginning, and we know that now.
Just think of him as your concealed carry. This is the Lars Larson Show.
What would you say if I told you that all of the criminal cases against Donald Trump are simply a setup, and that most of them are so thin they appear to be made of tissue paper, including the fraud case in which he was convicted and ordered to pay a $500 million fine, something that was absolutely insane? And you say a fraud case? Where nobody lost money and all the victims say they wanted to do business with the supposed fraudster again? Or how about the current one? The current one that says, yeah, we've got a state district attorney who wants to enforce a federal law because the state law has already run out and there was no falsification of business records. How about that one? Well, we think we can find him guilty in New York because we're going to get a New York City jury, and they have one. And we have a judge who's so bent, you can't believe it. And you know what? That judge can't gag me, so I can say that. You got that one as well. But then I want to get to the classified documents case. Do you remember when they did the raid on Donald Trump's home? When they raided Mar-a-Lago? And people wondered, well, what is this all about? Why would the FBI bring an entire SWAT team and deliberately raid Mar-a-Lago when the president, Trump, was out of town? Why would they do that? And why would they do it in August of that year? And the answer is because it was a setup. Now, let me make the case for that. I'd expect you to say, well, Lars, you got to back that up. Make us believe that there was a reason to set up Donald Trump. Because Donald Trump had documents that he was legally allowed to possess. And National Archives and Records Administration, known as NARA, was in contact with Trump's attorneys, and there were disagreements about which documents had to be returned to NARA and which documents were legally in the possession of Donald Trump. And you say, okay, but why would they go after him then, in the summer of that year? And the answer is that just a few weeks before the FBI raid on Mar-a-Lago, something significant happened. Joe Biden's attorneys found out that Joe, who now denies he knew any of this, had a whole bunch of classified documents that were stored in a whole bunch of places. They were stored famously in his garage at his house in Delaware. They were stored at the think tank that was funded by the Chinese Communist Party, think tank at University of Pennsylvania. I mean, they were stored all over the place. And there wasn't any special care taken to safeguard those records. Now, that's a pretty damning thing to have happen. And that was just a few weeks. They discovered the records, alerted the president's attorneys. Did they go right to National Archives? Did they go to the FBI and say, hey, it appears we've found a bunch of classified documents that Joe Biden claims he has no idea he had in his possession? Which is also interesting because just a few years before, Joe Biden was in the middle of writing his memoir. And, of course, he didn't write it. They had a ghostwriter writing it. And he went to the ghostwriter, and he, by the way, made $8 million on that book. And he said to the ghostwriter, I'm going to give you a bunch of classified documents that have to do with my time in office. But be careful with them. They're classified documents. I mean, to borrow a phrase from Watergate that was actually parodied back in the days of Watergate, what did the president know and when did he stop knowing it? We know for a fact that there were recordings of Joe Biden talking to his ghostwriter to write this book, telling the ghostwriter, I'm giving you classified documents to use in writing this book, but be careful with them. They are classified. So apparently, Joe Biden knew that he had classified documents in his possession. He also knew, because he was part of a law-making and law-writing body called the United States Senate for several decades, he knew that as a senator, he had absolutely no legal authority to take classified documents out of the building. He certainly had no authority to take them home. So all of a sudden, Joe Biden forgets that he has all these classified documents. He doesn't even know where they all are. The FBI is allowed. Now, imagine this. Usually the FBI tells you, we're going to come and search your place of business. We're going to search your home because we have probable cause to believe there may be evidence of a crime there. And did they do that? No, they negotiated with Joe Biden about what they were allowed to search and when they were allowed to search. So his lawyers had discovered these documents, and they knew there was political trouble coming. They knew that it was eventually going to go public, and the public was going to hear that for 5 decades, Joe Biden had illegally removed classified documents while he was a U.S. senator, that as a vice president to Barack Obama, he also took classified documents during that time period, and he had no legal authority to retain those either. And they also knew that if you have classified documents, there are specific laws and rules about how you're to safeguard them, that you have to keep them locked up, that they have to be under your control, that if you put them into a briefcase, the briefcase has to stay in your possession at all times. And he did absolutely none of that. So they knew that trouble was coming. So a few weeks later, Donald Trump's house gets raided. Well, what have we found out now? The FBI raid on Mar-a-Lago was a setup from the beginning to cover for document thief Joe Biden. A federal agency worked with a Trump transition team to send 2 pallets of document boxes related to former President Trump's presidency to his home at Mar-a-Lago, 1 year before special counsel Jack Smith had raided Donald Trump's home for classified documents. Now, the General Services Administration, which is part of the government, was in talks with Trump's team during and after his term of office about pallets of items from the president's tenure. And the GSA informed Trump's transition team that there were 6 pallets that had to be transferred, this is from the Federalist, from Virginia to Florida. They were anxious to get this stuff down there. And Kathy Geisler, the director of the Office of Portfolio Management, said, I understand they are ready to ship and that they wanted to send that. I know we originally had 3 pallets going to the storage unit. That is now 4 pallets going to the storage unit. 2 pallets of documents will go to Mar-a-Lago. Now, why would they want to ship all of these documents from the government's possession down to Donald Trump's home? An FBI agent said during a witness interview that the GSA was in possession of 6 pallets and that the office contacted them to inform them that 45, that's a reference to Trump, you know, that they have to go. Somebody has to pick them up. They have to be shipped or something to that effect. So in other words, Joe Biden's government was anxious to ship pallets of documents to Donald Trump's home. And then a year later, the FBI comes down and says, hey, we're going to raid your home while Donald Trump is out of town because we believe you're holding on to classified documents that literally could put the nation at risk. In fact, you remember all of the stories that popped after that raid on Mar-a-Lago. The stories that said he may have plans for nuclear weapons. He may have nuclear secrets. And the release of this information, having it out of the possession of the government, actually puts the United States of America in great jeopardy. Now, most of those stories have simply evaporated. I don't think they were true to begin with. I think what happened was Joe Biden and the people around him decided President Biden has a problem. He has stolen classified documents, and he needs to find an accusation he can make against Trump that will balance that up. And by the way, I know that a lot of people say that the Department of Justice exonerated Joe Biden. They did not. The special counsel that looked into Joe Biden's theft of classified documents did not say he didn't steal the documents. It did not say he kept the legal possession of them with the force of law. It simply said he is an elderly man with a bad memory and prosecuting him would be a bad idea. Well, at least that's one thing I could agree with. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
Lars Larson Show. Things you wish you could say. More with Lars.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm sure that, like me, you've probably been watching the craziness that's going on American college campuses right now. And I wanted to tell you, the lunacy of the kids who are doing this, and they are acting like children at this point. Columbia University is now discussing the idea of actually expelling students, not just suspending them, but saying, if you're doing this kind of thing, taking over buildings, we're simply going to expel you from the school altogether. And one of the students came out and said, well, the school is obligated to bring us food. And the reporter said, but you guys put yourself in that position. And the student said, nobody's asking them to bring us food. They're blocking access to the food. They're blocking access to food? Well, no, not exactly. They don't even know what they're protesting about. But what I do know is they are protesting at colleges that have allowed this to go on. And I've raised the question before, is it time to cut all federal funding that is now going to colleges and universities, both public and private, that are allowing these pro-terrorism protests? And Adam Andrzejewski joins me now, CEO and founder of Open the Books, the folks who dig into all those federal and even state documents and tell us the numbers that are inside. Adam, welcome back.
Hey, great to be on the program, Lars. Yeah, I think we can all agree, as a principal, not one single taxpayer dollar should go to any institution that's coddling bigotry, discrimination, or anti-Semitism, much less the genocide of the Jewish people and the wiping of Israel, our greatest ally in the Middle East, off the map. And so many people are disturbed by all of this moral rot at Columbia and our elite universities, but I think they should be more alarmed to know that you and I, Lars, we're actually funding this.
Yep. And funding it to an incredible degree. Columbia University, now I've given people an offhand number. I've said half a billion. How much money does Columbia University, a private institution, receive from the federal treasury?
So over the course of the past 5 years, our auditors at OpenTheBooks.com determined that Columbia received roughly $6 billion courtesy of the United States taxpayer, and this was only on federal contracts and grants. 90% of it was grants. Meanwhile, their endowment soared from $10 billion to over $13 billion. They didn't need taxpayer money, but they took it anyway.
And in fact, if you look at money being fungible, Adam, do you think it's fair to say that if you're getting all these government grants and they're coming to the school with very few strings attached, and your endowment goes from $10 billion to $13 billion, it increases by $3 billion at a time you were getting $6 billion from the feds, it's the U.S. taxpayers that have filled up their coffers.
100%. And so, look, number one, they need to lighten the load on the American taxpayer. Number two, Congress needs to hold hearings. Columbia, Harvard, other Ivy League institutions, other wealthy elite universities like Northwestern and Stanford, they're public charities underneath the IRS 501c3 code. And so they're supposed to operate in the public interest. Quite obviously, this moral rot that we're seeing on display is not in the public interest. And so Congress needs to hold hearings and put their IRS designation at risk. Number two is, the last time we did this report on the 8 schools of the Ivy League over a 6-year period from 2010 to 2015, we found that they were more federal contractor than they were educator. They collected more on federal contracts and grants from the U.S. taxpayer than what they collected from parents and students on undergraduate student tuition. And so, look, Congress needs to hike that 1.4% excessive endowments tax. They are using the taxpayer to fund their research while they collect private donations to stuff their endowment. And their endowment now at the Ivy League is over $200 billion, and we need to tax it. That 1.4% tax on gains on their endowment, that needs to go up to at least 23.5%. That's what wealthy Americans pay in the private sector on capital gains, and that's what these elite institutions should pay as well.
Well, and that's not unreasonable because, Adam, I don't know a lot about, you know, foundations and these other parts of tax law, but my understanding is you say, oh, you want to have a foundation that does certain kinds of charitable work. work. That's great. But you've got to spend the money that comes into the foundation. Well, can't we just collect it and endlessly build it bigger and bigger and bigger? And the answer is no. If you want special tax treatment and, you know, charities like this get special tax treatment, you've got to actually make use of the resources you have. And we've agreed to tax you at a very low rate. So if you, you know, gather up some money and you put it in investments because you want it to grow, you're only going to pay this de minimis amount of tax on the growth that you have in your money. Except, you know, isn't Harvard north of $50 billion in its endowment all by itself? So it's earning whatever 5% of $50 billion is every single year, whether a new dime, a dollar came in the door or not.
Yeah, and there's another layer to this too, Lars, and that is 38% of the entire student body at Columbia, they're foreign students. And Columbia does it because it pays the bills. Those foreign students oftentimes are funded by their governments who pay full tuition up to $80,000 and $90,000 at Columbia University. So if you're a student out there and a high achiever, an American citizen, and you have applied to Columbia and gotten rejected, well, roughly 4 out of 10 seats at the university are occupied now by foreign students. At MIT, it's 1 out of every 3 students. 33% of the student body is foreign. So when you take a look at Middle Eastern gifts and grants into Columbia, into institutions of higher education around the country, you know, a couple of years ago, we were all excited because the Chinese, over a 30-year period, had put a little less than $3 billion into Confucius Institutes and had done gifts and grants into America's higher ed. And underneath that white-hot spotlight, the Chinese retreated. They closed up those institutes. Well, four nations in the Middle East, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Kuwait, they've put in $10.3 billion into American higher ed. So, again, Congress needs to hold hearings. They're buying seats on these campuses, and they're crowding out American students from seats at the prestigious universities.
Well, and of course, since an awful lot of high-level government positions are filled with people from the Ivy League, if you come out of a school that feels it owes a lot, say, to the Middle East, because a lot of money is coming in, you're not going to hear a lot of criticism about the policies of those Middle Eastern countries, are you?
Well, and many of these, and here's the dirty little secret, many of these protesters that are protesting Israel and are backing terrorism and Hamas, they're foreign students. And so, look, they're here on an educational visa. When they violate university rules or state statutes, that visa should be pulled immediately. They need to be sent home.
And Florida, in fact, I think under DeSantis has actually said, if you're going to do this, we're going to have you bounced very quickly. You'll have your student visa pulled. Now, the visa is a federal issue, but at the state level, they can say, you know, if you're going to be in trouble legally in your status as a student, then you're going to be in trouble when it comes to your visa as well, right?
Yeah, and we took a look at Saudi Arabia. So Saudi Arabia has done more on gifts and grants than the Chinese have done over the course of the past 30 years. Saudi Arabia has actually put $3 billion into 240 colleges and universities around the country. So, for instance, at Columbia, we just crunched the numbers. Over the course of the last 2 years, they've purchased $5 million worth of seats over at Columbia. At MIT, they put in a $7 million restricted gift to help MIT build a research center. They have other restricted gifts where they get to pick. They get to put a Saudi Arabia student researcher on specific research projects at MIT. Again, tilting the playing field, crowding out other scientists because of their gifts and grants.
You got to take a look at these numbers. They're available at openthebooks.com. Adam Andrzejewski is the founder of it. And Adam, we always appreciate the information you bring to the show.
Thank you, Lars.
That is Adam Andrzejewski from openthebooks.com. Easy to remember, openthebooks.com. If you want to sound off, it's 866. Hey, Lars, send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you can vote in our poll on X. You'll find that at Lars Larson Show. We're on Instagram, The Lars Larson Show. And you can tell Alexa to play The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. With everything that's going on.
happy, informed, and always guessing what he'll say next. Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. This segment of the show is brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showings, no hassles, and you pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. Now, our poll on X today. Can a judge constitutionally gag a criminal defendant in a trial as he has done to President Donald Trump? I would say no. The judge has held Trump in contempt for violating his gag order and threatened the ex-president with jail time, but he only fined him $9,000, which I think is walking around money for Trump. But he fined him $9,000 because if he throws him in jail, I think that's going to go straight to the courts, the federal courts, and they're going to have to decide whether or not a judge who's got Donald Trump in front of him on criminal charges that really don't exist because they're about a federal law that Alvin Bragg cannot prosecute. I mean, a lot of levels of detail to that. Can he actually put a gag order on a presidential candidate? Today's poll on X is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let's go to Henry and Ben listening on the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, Henry, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Thank you, Lars. God bless you and your family abundantly for what you do. Train somebody, please, to take your place because you won't last forever.
I'm not leaving. Well, I'm not going to last forever. Maybe I'll have Payson. Payson's 8. Maybe by the time she's 18, she can step in for me.
The other thing is these people have taken over these schools. Cut the water, cut the electric, and no food. They'll come running out of there eventually, guaranteed.
I think that's a terrific idea, Henry. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Jamie. Hey, Jamie, welcome to the program, and thanks for listening. What's on your mind?
Yeah. Hey, Lars, I'm the electric chainsaw guy. Hated it. Well, hey, the unemployment deal, it's about ready to kill us down here in Southern Oregon.
Because the employment department put in a brand new $106 million computer and it doesn't work?
Yeah, it doesn't work. Before it happened, when we went into the unemployment office, you got it or you didn't get it. People listen. Computers don't listen. The only problem is it's for the state, by the state, of the state. It's not for the people. We're here. And it's killing me. I'm the electric chainsaw guy that, you know, hang on. I hate the electric deal. Moved to Southern Oregon thinking everything was great. Got laid off. Well, I'm on unemployment and I can't get it.
And that's not, that needs to be answered. And clearly, Governor Kotek is so consumed with trying to make her wife, Amy Kotek Wilson, a part of state government when she was never elected by anybody. She's so consumed with her personal problems that she can't take on the actual issues of the state. Let's go to Eric. Hey, Eric, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Lars. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I just couldn't help but noticing it seems like there's more organized resistance to the protests at the universities now than there was during the George Floyd riots. And I don't know if you had any thoughts on that as well. Like, why do you think there's more organized resistance now?
Okay, I think one of the reasons is that the riots that were sponsored by Antifa and BLM that led to 36 murders over that year and $3 billion at least in property damage, but they were popping up anywhere in cities all over America, and they were doing a tremendous amount of damage. The on-campus demonstrations are very organized, and they're at least at three colleges, they're backed by George Soros. But they're somewhat limited as to where they're going to have these so-called protests, these encampments. Whereas the Antifa and BLM riots, they could be anywhere in a city. And in a lot of cities, like Seattle, like Portland, they moved around. They had some flexibility to move them around. When you're doing a protest that's allegedly aimed at the university by university students, it's constrained to that physical piece of property, right?
Yeah, okay, I see.
And for example, PSU, which apparently has turned over the university to Hamas, we literally had a soundbite with the PSU president, Ann Cudd, who's apparently chewing her cud because she's saying, well, I asked the protesters, could we please still have access to our library? She's given the university, a state institution, over to the control of the protesters. But where did those protesters come from? Well, they had staged a bunch of protests in the city park blocks, and the city of Portland and its police went to them and said, you're breaking the law, you need to leave the park blocks, and they booted them out. And then Anne Cudd, who gets two-thirds of $1 million a year to run a university, decided to offer this bunch a free place to camp. She said, you can go ahead and camp on this portico out in front of the major university library, Miller Library. And she said, but just allow us to get in and out of the library. Well, then the protesters decided that wasn't enough, so they broke into the building and they did damage. And now they've got themselves in criminal trouble. The only problem is they're in a politically correct city that doesn't want to touch protesters. I mean, I know that the DA and the police chief and the mayor all said, well, you know, we are going to consider criminal charges. That was the wrong message. The message should have been, yeah, you've now broken the law, and we're going to track down every one of you that has broken the law, and we will charge you with the crimes you have committed. They didn't send that message. They sent a soft message. We're going to look at it. We're going to gather all the information, and then we'll decide whether or not what criminal charges should be brought. They're telling the protesters, you now own Portland State University, and that is just dead wrong. Cut off the state funding and the federal funding.
The Lars Larson Show.
Ladies and gentlemen,
you ready for the big show?
You're ready?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air. Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because they're cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars. Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Tuesday, and I can tell you that in places like Everett, that there are kids who are being killed by the fentanyl scourge that has affected the whole Northwest, and literally in Oregon and Washington, thousands of people dying of overdoses from this illegal drug. I mean, it does have a few medical uses. They're very relatively limited because it's a very, very powerful drug. And so its medical use is very limited, but its illegal use, it's everywhere. You can buy the pills for almost nothing. And now we've seen, for example, in Everett, three infants overdosed on fentanyl in just 4 days in a single week, including a 13-month-old who died. So I've invited Washington State Senator John Braun on to talk about what might be done about this. Senator, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on, Lars.
So what are our possible range of options? Because it doesn't seem that Jay Inslee or the majority in Olympia want to do anything about this problem. So are we just fated to see a whole bunch of kids and a whole bunch of adults die in the next 12 months?
No, I think we are morally responsible to do something about this. And we have been working on this. We have had a bill this last session from Senator Linda Wilson that would have added exposure to fentanyl to the child endangerment law. It already includes, you know, if you expose young children to other drugs, methamphetamine, heroin, whatever, that's a felony, right? You can be charged with a crime and convicted in due time. However, fentanyl didn't exist when this law was created, so it's not in the statute. Therefore, there is no crime if you expose children to fentanyl. We ought to at the very least fix that. And I'm not saying, you know, even if you take the position that folks who are exposing children, they don't do it purposely, they're just subject to addiction. Okay, I can buy that. But we still have to do something about it. We can't let children be exposed to these dangerous drugs and sit on their hands and continue to watch this happen. We've had an explosion, not only in fentanyl use, as you mentioned earlier, but of children exposed and in some cases dying as a result of the exposure to fentanyl.
Well, is there anything wrong with saying It doesn't matter whether you deliberately exposed the child or accidentally exposed him. I don't imagine most drug addicts are very responsible about their drug use. I mean, that's the nature of what they're doing. They're taking an illegal drug. Why would we expect them to be, say, as responsible as a medical a doctor, a nurse, or a lab tech, or a pharmacist? They're all required by law to be responsible, but these users of illegal drugs can expose their kids. I don't have a problem with saying that's a crime, and you can't do that.
I don't have any problem at all with saying that's a crime. In fact, that's exactly what we did in the Washington State Senate this year. I mean, in this bill, just to be clear, it wasn't a partisan bill. It left the state Senate with a unanimous vote from, you know, both sides of the aisle voted for it. And then the chair of the Community Safety, Justice and Reentry Committee in the House refused to even give it a hearing, claiming that there were not a single vote, a person in the 58 Democrats in the House who would vote for the bill. Therefore, it didn't even deserve a hearing.
It's not
the fact
one?
That it came out of the Senate.
Yeah. Not one?
No, that's what he claims. Very, very public claim that no one would vote for it. Therefore, it didn't deserve action. It's a travesty. You know, the hypocrisy of naming the committee, starting with community safety, and then refusing to even hear a bill that helped that would make their implement consequences when people expose young children to fentanyl is just
well. Senator, tell me this. When you go to your colleagues, I imagine you talk to your colleagues on the other side of the aisle. I end up talking to loony lefties from time to time on the show when they call in. When you say to them, what's your objection to making it a crime to expose a child to something that can either make the child extraordinarily sick, I mean emergency room sick, or even dead, what do they tell you?
It's all ideology. They won't really defend their position, but this is all wrapped up in the idea that we can't make more crimes. We can't make more restrictive criminal system. It's an effort to protect the criminals at the expense of the victims. In this case, the victims are young, often infant children. It's ideology. It's not logic. It's not an explanation. And it's an excuse for no action when action is demanded.
Well, and when you say making a new crime, I mean, I think we could agree generically that any time and anyhow that you hurt a child is a criminal act. I mean, there's nothing you can do that physically damages a child and even puts the child at risk of dying that can't be a crime, even if somebody hasn't written it down in a law book. Can we agree to that?
Yeah, I mean, in my view, this is certainly a crime. The challenge, and if the child dies tragically, it most certainly it's a crime that can be charged. But if they're just in danger, they save them, luckily, with some sort of treatment. They can't, under the current law, they can't be charged, even though any reasonable person would look at that and say that's 100% a crime as intended by the statute. It's just fentanyl's not listed. This is a very simple, straightforward. It's only the first step. Let's be clear about this. This is a step that starts to give a little bit of protection to these innocent victims. But we got a long way to go. We've talked about this before on getting our society, back in the right direction when it comes to the use, abuse, the addiction of hard drugs. But what we do know is allowing there to be no consequences when people are injured or, sometimes seriously or even killed is wrong. It's wrong. We can't continue to do that and expect this problem to fix itself.
You know, Senator, maybe you'll see the connection, maybe not. This is not about drugs, but last week there was a man from the Tri-Cities who ended up blowing his own brains out after he killed his ex-wife, after he killed his 17-year-old, I would say, victim that he had met in middle school at age 11. And it sounds to me like that needs a good, hard investigation, because this is a guy who was a school cop, and he meets this 11-year-old girl. And questions were raised fairly quickly about what kind of relationship he had developed with this 11-year-old girl. And there were people, other students, who said, hey, there are Snapchats going around saying this 33, 35-year-old man was having sex with his 11 or 12-year-old girl. And the schools ended up letting him go as a school resource officer. But then when he applied for a job as a substitute teacher at another district just down the road, he got an entirely positive recommendation from his former employer. And when they investigated what he was alleged to have done, they said, oh, we never got a search warrant to demand his phone so we could see the kind of messages that he was sending to these girls. So we didn't have enough to charge him, and nothing got done. Well, guess what? That girl, now 17 years old, is dead because she was shot to death by this guy who also shot his ex-wife in front of their 9-year-old kid. Lots of damage going around to lots, and these are all actions being done because folks in the schools don't follow the mandatory reporting law. I'd love to see you look into that one as well. That's Senator John Braun. Glad to have you on, Senator. In a moment, we got to talk about these Soros prosecutors who say they'll prosecute again, but only to help the Democrat Party during its big convention this summer in Chicago. I'll get you details, and your phone calls and emails are next on the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest. Here's Lars Larson. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your calls. I want to do that first, but in a moment, I'm going to tell you about what's going on in Chicago. The big county that encompasses most of the city of Chicago is Cook County, and they have spent the last 4 years avoiding at all costs any prosecution of criminal violations that are tied to protests and demonstrations. They didn't want to prosecute those people because they tend to be left-wing demonstrations. And of course, Cook County is going to try to help out the Democrats. The problem is they've got a big convention coming. The Democrat convention will be in Chicago, Illinois this summer. So now they're going to change because, as we all know, the Democrats have to have double standards or they'd have no standards at all. But let me get to the details on that in just a moment. First, if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. And naysayers always go to the head of the line. You can also send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And our poll on X today, found at Lars Larson Show: can a judge constitutionally gag a defendant like Donald Trump? Well, a judge in New York City did just that today. He gagged him. Well, the gag order's been in place for a while. The judge decided that the president, President Trump, has violated that gag order, and he threatened to throw him in jail, but he only fined him $9,000 because if he throws him in jail, that becomes an issue for the federal courts, whether or not the judge can constitutionally gag somebody and whether or not it's going to be something you can throw somebody in jail for. In America, to engage in free speech and be threatened with jail by a judge, that is a ripe constitutional issue. But let's go first to Jeff. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. You wanted to talk about the crazy protests that are going on American college campuses?
Yeah, I think the solutions, there's two simple solutions, I think. One is lock every single one of them up. Go handcuff them and throw them all in jail and watch them cry. And I bet you that their support for Palestine will, the Palestinians will diminish very rapidly, because none of them are thinking that they're going to get thrown in jail. And yep, the other choice is to remove everybody from the college campus, let them finish online, cancel all the graduations, shut the whole campus down, and then if these idiots want to go camp inside of a yard or in a park in an empty college campus, then let them do that. And I bet you if you did that, also the support for the Palestinians will diminish rapidly. But as long as they get on the news every day and everybody's so outraged, then they're empowered. So I think you treat them like the petulant little idiots that they are, and they get nothing, and they get no attention, and they go to jail, or, you know, or we can continue down this road.
Jeff, do you mind if I do just a fine-tuning of your idea? Because I like much of the idea, but I don't really want to throw them in jail and turn them into martyrs, because that's the way they'll treat it. There have been too many activists over the years who've said, well, you know, I had to sit in jail for a day or two or three, and they'll view it as something that actually enhances their cause. Why I went to jail to support my point of view about supporting terrorists in the Middle East, which I still have a tough time wrapping my head around that. The second problem, and so what my suggestion has always been, going all the way back to the beginning of the Antifa and BLM riots, was when they show up, the minute they break the law, even a traffic law, blocking a street, zip cuffs and load them on a city bus. And when you've got enough of them to fill a bus, drive the bus off to a police precinct that is as far away from the scene as you can possibly get, and then load another bus. And if you do that, you make their life difficult. And they say, all that's going to happen to me is I'm going to get zip cuffed and taken away and dropped off out, you know, maybe some distance away from where the protest is. There's not much martyrdom that you can find in that. That's one thing. The other idea about shutting the universities down, this is why I object to that, Jeff, because the ones who are out there protesting, they deserve some kind of consequence. But what about the students, and it may be the vast majority of students, who just want to go to college? Now, I think they made bad choices when they chose colleges like Columbia and Harvard because they're left-wing indoctrination centers. But I've met too many young men and women who kept their conservative values, even though they were thrown into this cesspool of liberal indoctrination. If we shut the university down, then we're punishing them too, and they didn't do anything wrong. And philosophically, it's tough for me to say, well, we're going to punish all of you, whether you broke the law or not. That doesn't sound very American to me. And so if you say, no, we're going to take back control of the college, and the college is for the students who want to come and learn, the college is not there to provide a soapbox for whatever issue it is that you want to protest about, whether it's Black Lives Matter, whether it's Antifa, whether it's Palestinian terrorists or Hamas terrorists, but don't punish the kids who aren't doing anything wrong. Could we agree on that?
Yeah, I think it would be a crying shame to have all those kids not get to graduate or do all those things. But
yep.
At the same time, then you're making every single Democrat that supports this kind of garbage and every single university president and every single faculty member own it, right?
Well,
Jeff. 90% of the students leave Columbia College unsatisfied because they were cheated out of their graduation or their classes by a minority of people who choose to protest in favor of terrorists with the support of faculty, then they own that. And then next year, guess what? My mom and dad aren't going to send me back to Columbia next year.
And I will tell you, some of the Ivy League colleges have seen a drop in admissions, but they're nowhere near running out of kids who want to have a Harvard degree or a Columbia degree. I wouldn't give you 10 cents for it, but they know that, you know, 5, 10, 20 years from now, that Harvard degree will be worth big money, you know, depending on the kind of, you know, if you actually got a degree in something that matters. But I understand the point you're making, but I think the better victory over these Hamas terrorist supporters is to say, hey, look, the college is operating just fine. You, on the other hand, are locked out. The college will go on. And then I think the colleges and their boards of trustees need to make some serious changes in the way those universities are run. Because all of these school administrators who make huge salaries, hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars, their paychecks are going to go on. Whether you shut the college down or not, they're still all going to get paid. So when you say, we're going to make you own it, You're just saying, well, you mean I'm not going to have to teach classes anymore, but I still get my paycheck? It's not much of a punishment. On the other hand, if you say, we're going to lock out all these little, you know, schmog-wearing idiots. And by the way, I want to mention one thing, Jeff. This may not come through to a lot of Americans, but this headscarf that they're all wearing, the one with the black and white checks on it, do you know why that's so significant?
I do not.
Okay. If you showed up at a rally and you said, I'm going to bring with me my Confederate flag, what do you suppose the reaction even from a lot of staunch conservatives would be?
You're an idiot. Don't do that.
Yeah, you're an idiot. Don't do that. And I know all the arguments about the Confederate flag, but you know that that flag has a meaning. This checked scarf that they're all wearing, in the Middle East, that is the scarf of Yasser Arafat. That is the scarf of terrorists. It's not just as it's been described by too many media as, oh, it's just typical Arab headgear. You wear that stuff, you are telling everybody around you, I ally myself with a terrorist organization. And in America, there isn't a similar, maybe the swastika would be a similar symbol to what that Czech scarf is. Understand what it means. They're wearing it for a reason.
The Lars Larson Show. Best investment in talk radio, and it's free. Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and your emails. You know, I know with all the protests going on and all, I want to get to something a whole lot more pedestrian, and that is social media and the threat that it poses to your children, a threat that we probably wouldn't have even realized maybe even 20 years ago, to say if your kid has a smartphone, that this might be a device that is used to put things in front of your child that are absolutely inappropriate, potentially even damaging, and even allowing perverts and pedophiles to reach out to your children inside your own home. So maybe there should be some limits. Well, Florida has now put a limit on it, saying children under the age of 14 cannot create a social media account in the state. Now, that bill takes effect January of next year. It gives parents a greater ability to protect their children. And it does raise the question, what is the youngest age that somebody should be in order to access social media? Colin Ritter joins me now, a senior research associate for EdChoice. Colin, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Lars.
So you did an EdChoice survey, and you actually surveyed not parents but teenagers. What'd you find out?
Yeah, so we typically do each month we survey parents and the Gen Pop, but twice a year we survey teens and teachers, and typically those are my favorite surveys just because, especially with teens, they're so, you know, outward in their opinion, and they're very brutally honest, which is something to appreciate, especially as a researcher trying to get at what they're seeing every day in their school. You mentioned the Florida bill. Teens are actually pretty close to agreeing with that. They think there's a good portion, about a third of teens say that you should be at least 14 to be able to access social media. So they're in agreement there. There is, you know, two-thirds of teens that think it should be younger than 14, but then 13 is kind of the age where teens are kind of split.
Let me ask you this, Colin, does that result surprise you in that, you know, most kids, if you ask them, what should you be allowed to do? I mean, I know that most of them would say, well, I should be able to do just about anything. I should be able to maybe drink a beer or, you know, drive the car or whatever. They want to be able to do more than perhaps they're mature enough to be able to do. But does it surprise you that when you ask the teens, because they know it, they're on social media, they see what it can do, both good and bad, and they say, yeah, 13 or 14 is probably about the right age. Does that surprise you that they would say that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, you make a good point. Teens do kind of feel, you know, that there's that rebellious side of them that thinks that they can do anything.
I mean, why can't I get a body piercing, Mom?
Exactly. And it was a little surprising. I guess I thought it would be a little younger. Teens might think that, you know, age 10 or 11 might be fine. But, yeah, I guess I was a little surprised. But then we have a follow-up question that says, you know, what kind of impact do you think social media has had on you in these following areas? And, you know, 40% of teens said that it's had a negative impact on their mental health. So while teens think that they should be able to access it at a, you know, age 13, they are also aware of the fact that it does have a negative impact. It's not just this great tool that everyone should have. There's consequences to it.
I mean, because, Colin, when I look at social media, which came about after I was already an adult, but I look at it and I think, man, I can't imagine how a kid would react to having some of this stuff put in front of him or her, you know, and maybe they'd realize, hey, this isn't really good for me, you know, and maybe they wouldn't. Maybe they'd say, hey, I like having access to all this information, even though I'm not the right age. And yet these people are the people closest to it who grew up with it. So if anybody knows, they should, shouldn't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and personally for me, when I was in high school and things like that, Facebook was first you know, gaining popularity. And for me, and I'm sure other teams feel this way as well, in that moment, it was sort of a, oh, well, my friend has it. I want, you know, I want that. So you ask your parents, and it kind of spreads like wildfire at that point. So you're right. There's a little bit of that.
Let me ask you this, because one of the things that came up when DeSantis, when this bill was passed and DeSantis said he was going to sign it, I thought, yep, okay, well and good. How are you going to do that? Because I would imagine that there are going to be parents who say, oh, no, there shouldn't be any limit. Does that mean that parents might just go out and create the social media accounts and allow their kids to access them if they really think 14 is not the right place to put the limit?
I mean, I think parents could do that. It's relatively straightforward in the bill once you look at it. And, you know, I believe age 14 and 15, you have to get parental consent to do it. I think once age 16 hits, then it's, you know, it's free reign. You don't need a parent to sign off on it. I'm sure there will be parents who think their 12, 13-year-old will be fine to do it. Then maybe they can sign it up under their name. I don't know exactly what kind of guardrails are in place to protect from that. But I do know that this is something that they've been working on for a while, and, you know, it's going to happen in January. I guess we're going to see real quick, what kind of reaction, what kind of stems from it once it's implemented.
Well, and you'd almost think that some of the social media companies would say, hey, this isn't such a bad idea. We don't like the grief that we get. And they probably, yeah, rightly get grief when some 13-year-old girl becomes distraught over the things people are saying about her on social media and sadly takes her own life. I mean, social media companies you'd think would want to avoid all of that if they possibly could, or being accused of, you know, exposing kids to age inappropriate stuff, to put it politely, that they would want. And what has the reaction been from the social media companies to this new law?
You know, you would think that, I want to agree as well, but I mean, we know some of the people, you know, not personally, but we know some of the personalities in charge of these things, and I'm not sure if, you know, limiting and kind of impacting the bottom line and saying who can and can't use the social media is totally something they're in love with. I don't know. I don't have off the top of my head exactly what the response has been. I know that this has been coming for a while, and especially with everything that's gone on with TikTok, you know, like kind of mitigating the impact of social media on minors has been such a hot topic for quite a while that you would think that eventually they would have to succumb to the status quo. It's like, yes, this is, you know, there is stuff on here that 10, 11, 12-year-olds shouldn't be accessing, and there needs to be some sort of system in place, you know, how that is implemented and who that's implemented by, whether it's federal or at the state level. In this case, it's at the state level. I would love to see what the general public and parents would say about it, but I'd assume it's generally a favorable feeling.
I mean, and when you talk about the commercial value and having them worried about their bottom line, I'm not exactly sure that 12-year-olds are the biggest consumers in America, maybe of toys or some clothing, but for the most part, they're not buying cars, they're not taking out mortgages. You know, I wouldn't worry about them until they actually have the ability to make some money and spend it. At 14, I'm not even sure how many parents allow their 14-year-old, hey, go ahead, get on Amazon, order anything you want. In fact, we've seen famous crash and burns when that happens, and the kid orders $6,000 worth of something off of Amazon, and it doesn't work out well for mom or dad because they're on the hook.
Correct. Yeah. No. And I don't think that they're exactly worried about like actual profit. But I mean, in terms of just the general number and, you know, quantity of accounts made and things like that, that's something you can sell to advertisers or people trying to, you know, advertise on the website, and they say, hey, look, we have, you know, X amount of new users. We have X amount, you know, companies are looking for to get into younger markets, things like that. It's like, okay, we have this amount of, you know, kids in high school, things like that. So I think you're right. It's probably being a little dramatic worrying about the bottom line. But I mean,
I'm headed up to a break. Tell my audience where they can find the results of the EdChoice survey, if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. So our website is edchoice.morningconsoleintelligence.com. That's a subset of our normal website, edchoice.org, but we have, monthly surveys of the general population of parents. We have semi-annual surveys of teachers and teenagers as well, and we love any sort of feedback.
It's fascinating data. That's Colin Ritter, who's a senior research associate at EdChoice. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. I'm on the phone today.
No need to adjust your volume. He's just that loud. Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on this Tuesday. I've got a couple of breaking news items that just came in literally in the last 30 minutes. Number one, and neither one of those is going to make you happy. The Biden administration is considering bringing Palestinian refugees to the United States as refugees. Now, just let that sink in for a moment. These are people, the Palestinians, a huge number of them support Hamas terrorism, 70% according to the polls. This is a group of people that is so disliked by even their Arab brethren. Egypt doesn't want anything to do with them. Jordan doesn't want anything to do with them. And obviously, they've been plenty of trouble for Israel. And now Joe Biden wants to bring them here, and he's going to vet them how? And we're going to pay their bills. We're going to put them up somewhere. And this is going to be just like all the other illegals that have been brought to the United States, except these people will be coming from a place whose neighbors don't even want them to come in. Egypt has put up the kind of barrier wall that we ought to have on our southern border. They put up a barrier wall to make sure that the Palestinians do not come from Gaza, which is part of Israel, but it's Gaza, into Egypt. And Joe Biden wants to say, hey, yeah, let's bring some plane loads of those folks in. And then you've got this. Remember when in his State of the Union address, Joe Biden announced, we're going to build an emergency aid pier off of Gaza. There are already plenty of ways to truck things into Gaza. There are entry points from Egypt. There are multiple entry points from the State of Israel. But the problem is the Palestinian terrorists make it awfully dangerous to open up those points because they will try to bring in bombs and bullets and other things that terrorists love to play with. So Joe Biden, and I think it caught a lot of people, he certainly caught me off guard the night he announced, we're going to build this emergency pier. And it's going to be quite a pier, too. A third of $1 billion, $320 million is the estimated cost that American taxpayers will pay to build a temporary pier off Gaza. So what? They can smuggle more bombs and bullets into Gaza. But then this broke less than half an hour ago. The Defense Secretary of the United States, Lloyd Austin, has been answering the questions that a lot of us started asking the night of that State of the Union address when we turned to our friends and said, hold on a second. We're going to have members of the United States military, the Navy and others, and they're going to build a pier into an active war zone. What happens when the Hamas terrorists start to shoot at American service members? Well, we have our answer. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has said that when this thing starts, it was supposed to start in March. Now I guess it's starting in May. It shouldn't be happening at all. $320 million American dollars to build a floating humanitarian pier along the Gaza Strip. And since Lloyd Austin was up on Capitol Hill, he was asked, well, what happens when our guys and gals in our military who are building this begin to have people shoot at them? Which I think is a fairly reasonable thing to expect is going to happen. Guess what he told them? That our service members will be allowed to return fire, which on its face is absolutely reasonable. But I just ask you to imagine, if you think we've got the amount of trouble we've got in this country right now, and then we start importing Palestinians to the United States, and we're going to give them the full refugee treatment, which means access to any of the social programs that America has right now that are currently being overburdened by Joe Biden's invasion of 10 million illegal aliens over the last 3 years. And now we're going to bring in, what, thousands? There are 2.5 million people in Gaza. How many of those people are going to be brought into the United States and then treated as refugees? We will be giving them resources that we're told we don't have for American homeless, for American drug addicts, for American veterans, or anybody else. And then when the Gaza Hamas terrorists start to shoot at our service members and they shoot back and kill some of the Hamas terrorists, what do you suppose the domestic reaction is going to be to that? Let's go to Doug in Bellingham, listening on KGMI. Hey, Doug, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. Thanks for taking my call. You were talking earlier to a gentleman about the headgear that the protesters are wearing, the black
kafia.
And white.
Yeah.
Yeah. That clicked into me. When I was in the Navy in 1982.
Thank you.
We sat off the coast of Lebanon for 4 months, and it was 4th of July every night when the sun goes down. You can see all this stuff going on. But funny story, we were part of a multinational group that escorted Arafat and several of the PLO out of Lebanon to Tunisia. And when we were doing that, we were close enough with a pair of binoculars. Arafat had, like, I'd say a mid-sized yacht, and he was sitting there. You could see him. He was sitting there.
He got rich off that whole deal, didn't he?
Yeah. And he had women around him, and then several hundred yards behind there was like a flatbed, not flatbed, but open ship with, I'd say, hundreds of men, and they're hanging over the side puking. And it was such a dynamic to see. And that, when you were talking about it, it just clicked into my head. It was like, wow, and here we are again. Look at where we are.
Yeah, and we're worse because now we're going to build them a floating pier. We're going to put American service members in harm's way. And it's funny because Lloyd Austin was asked, well, thank you for the call, Doug, and thanks for your service. President Biden told the country we weren't going to have boots on the ground in Gaza. And Austin said, we will not. And he says, oh, but they're going to be in harm's way. They get shot at, but they don't have boots.